Welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. I am your host, Chris Panaski. This podcast was created so as to share the stories of bike tours, bike packers, and endurance racers from around the world as they embark on amazing adventures. Through their stories, you'll be able to learn the ins and outs of bike travel. You'll get insight into various countries and cultures, hear fantastic stories of their journeys, and through both mine and my guests' experiences, you'll learn about the pros and cons of specific gear, bikes, and bike setups. If you're new to bike travel and considering going on an adventure, I hope the podcast provides you with that extra little bit of motivation to make it happen. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is proudly supported by Panorama Cycles, Redshift Sports, Tailfin Bikepacking Equipment, Race Day Fuel, and Full Cycle Ottawa. Their continued support allows me to focus my efforts on providing you amazing content. Now back to the show. Welcome back to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast. In this episode, I sit down with Seb, a marketing exec turned solo bikepacking adventurer, whose journey across the rail trails of America began with a career detour and became a deliberate pursuit of clarity, connection, and challenge. From navigating rainforest mishaps and bear encounters to whitewater wipeouts and tornado warnings, Seb's ride is anything but ordinary. We talk gear choices, e-bike debates, saddle woes, and the surprising joy of solitude. Whether you're planning your own escape or just love a good story, this episode is packed with insight, inspiration, and a reminder that sometimes the best adventures begin when life throws you off course. The Bikepack Adventures Podcast is supported by some pretty rad companies. A couple of them are Panorama Cycles and Full Cycle Ottawa. The new Panorama Katadin 2.1 is a gravel rig tuned for long-haul comfort and wild terrain. Built with lighter tubing and progressive geometry, the frame has also been tested to full mountain bike standards for durability and peace of mind, even when the trail disappears and the terrain gets rowdy. With integrated mounts, generous tire clearance, and reliability-first components, it's the bikepacker's dream machine. Roll deeper, explore wilder, ride the Katadin 2.1. On gravel roads or cruising through city streets, Full Cycle Ottawa has been your trusted ride companion for over 30 years. Locally rooted and rider-approved, they stock top-tier bikes from legendary brands like Norco, Cannondale, Cervelo, and distribute Panorama Cycles. From expert service to cutting-edge gear, Full Cycle keeps your wheels turning. Ready to roll? Swing by today. Your next adventure starts at Full Cycle Ottawa. Seb, welcome to the Bikepack Adventures Podcast.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to join you.
Yeah, and thank you for these wonderful headphones.
Oh, good.
They're fantastic. Yeah, definitely right at the right time. We are going to talk about your big adventure, and I think it's really interesting. And there are a lot of ways that if we had done this conversation, it might have changed how my own wife and I did our trip just recently. Mm. But we didn't, and never kind of crossed my mind until it was too late. So you called it the deliberate detour. Do you want to tell us what inspired this name? And was it just kind of a fluky coincidence or somebody at a pub that just kind of pitched something out there?
Sure. Yeah, so I had listened to your podcast, Bella Malloy's podcast, and others for probably two years odd. Mm-hmm. I got into Zain Abdullah, who's the Aussie fellow who's run and won, I think, the race across America, race across Australia.
Okay.
A fellow called Rupert Guinness. He's a journalist, a cycling journalist. He's ridden across Australia, read his book. I kind of got the bug, and I just couldn't get my head around how I'd ever find the time to do it, get the time off work. And then fortuitously, my role got made redundant. So in Australia, that means you're not being replaced or laid off. It's just your role, it's gone, just gone away.
Okay.
It's pretty common. It's financial savings. So I had 7 really great years at Australia's biggest poultry company. In a quite a senior role, and so I never had the time to do it, and suddenly I had the time and the money.
I was going to say, because like typically when you become redundant, they've got to buy out, you know, your time, right? Is it maybe 1 month per year typically or whatever?
Yeah, something like that. And then yeah. Because I was at what we call the C-suite level.
Okay, yeah.
I had more than that, so
sweet.
Had that time and money intersection for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the name of it actually came from Claude. So Claude's like a ChatGPT. So I sort of put in there, you know, middle-aged man, made redundant, looking to find himself across the Rail Trails of America, and it came up with a list, and then it spat out the Deliberate Detour, which was just perfect.
Very interesting. And Claude is from which AI?
It's Claude. It's an open source. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think it's they're all quite similar.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
It was just the one that I was using at the time, and I thought, brilliant.
Sweet. And what was a little bit about your life before embarking on this adventure? So tell us about Seb, Sebastian, I presume.
Sure. So I grew up in Sydney, Australia, where I'm talking to you from today. Mm-hmm. Discovered cycling pretty early. Like at 14, I was riding 30, 40 Ks on the road, which I would never let my 13-year-old do, actually, now. used to ride my bike to school, quite active. Went into marketing as a profession. Studied university, went into marketing. Did 4 years in Melbourne. That was great. I did three and a half years in Toronto, in Canada, near yourself. And then I did 3.5 years in New York. All for sort of Pepsi breweries, big Carlton United, big breweries. And then discovered the interesting world of poultry, which you probably wouldn't think is that interesting, but it's a fascinating industry to work in. Moved back to Sydney, kept cycling less so, but always active, always gym, always cycling, walking outdoors. Obviously, we've got an amazing, you know, middle of winter here, it can be 25 and sunny.
Celsius. That's amazing. And was it like, were you more of a roadie or mountain biking or a little bit of everything?
Yeah, road. I've never really done mountain. I had never done gravel until the start of this ride.
Yeah, yeah.
So road, kind of, you know, I don't know, 70 to 100 on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty typical.
Yeah, that's a very typical, like, I feel like us middle-aged men getting out on that one big ride a weekend. And and then not.
my only issue I've got is I'm a big guy, so I'm 6'1", 6'2". In winter when I hibernate, I can hit, you know, 110 kilos.
Okay.
So I've always struggled going up hills.
Me, yeah.
And I've always struggled in a peloton.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know that feeling. I lived in Asia for a while, so when I was cycling in Malaysia, I was the equivalent of you compared to all my Chinese friends.
Yeah, of course.
We'd hit a hill and they'd just be gone. I'm like, come back.
Yeah, no. And the Australian peloton way is, we don't wait for you. catch up when you're ready.
I could only hope that we had a big downhill coming, because then I would catch up. But
yes, exactly right. Yeah, the Rolling Stone picks up, gathers no moss, and
exactly
catch them on the downhills. Exactly. Or they make you sit on the front and block the wind. So.
Oh, yeah, they love that. Yeah, everybody was fighting to be behind me. Oh, that's very, very cool. And so then, yeah, you spent 7 years working here in Sydney, right? And
So last 7 years in Sydney, yeah.
Okay. And was there like a defining moment? I guess you said it was kind of like a mix of podcasts and books and stuff that wanted to push you towards something long distance, exploration type adventures.
There was. I was sitting chatting to my wife one night, probably a year ago, and I'd got deep into planning. Like, I had my spreadsheet out and I had decided the route I was going to take, and I had started to weigh equipment and sort of think, how much could I carry? Still with no real plan to do this. And she kind of said, well, like, are you in or you're out? Like, what's the plan here? And I said, well, probably got to find a way to not work for 3 months, and you know that,
right?
Again, that hadn't happened. So really the defining moment is when they kind of said, hey, you know, we've loved having you here, but we don't need you going forward. And that was like, right. And that was sort of, that was March 20th of this year, and I left Australia on April 27th. So I had 4 weeks and 2 days or something to like really plan it and get fit. But that was that the defining moment was probably the right. Now I've got the
just time. The stars aligned.
Yep. They did. Yeah.
Did you always, and you, it sounds like you always had a love of the outdoors. Was that something as part of your upbringing? Were your parents active? Was it something that was pushed through the family?
Not really. mum was an artist and very indoor focused. Dad, a lot of people sail in Sydney.
Okay.
It sounds like a wealthy man's sport. It's not at all here. You know, you can buy a boat for 15 grand type thing.
It's a lot of
fun sailing. Yeah, same in Canada, exactly.
Yeah.
So no, it's all me really, not really a sporty family. I think I have a love of exercise. I don't really have a love of the outdoors. So I hadn't camped outdoors for 25 years until one night on the tour, which we can talk about later. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly not a camper. I don't like tents. I don't like wildlife. We've got a lot of wildlife in Australia that can come knocking at your tent during the night.
Yeah, there's a lot of everything. I feel like Australia is like everything's out there to kill you. Everything's poisonous.
Yep. I saw a brown snake last week, which you're very unlikely to survive a snake bite in the bush.
Okay.
You've sort of got 10 minutes to get to hospital type thing.
Yeah, you can't just like lean over, suck the venom out.
No.
Do that. Not careful incision right above it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an eastern brown. You can look it up. It's top 10 deadliest in the world. Yeah, you're not surviving that one. So, yeah, just never really loved being outdoors in terms of sunsets and nature and camping, mm-hmm. but being outside and exercising all day.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. And well, let's talk about this. Let's dive into this tour before we start talking about the gear and the bike and stuff. But what was the original vision? You know, like you had watched, I'm sure you'd watched the Divide, and you've seen these documentaries, and you know, it's there's so much options now too, with so many routes. What was kind of your original vision, and how did that change as you got closer to the date?
So the original vision I actually ended up sticking with, and that was to stay safe. And so Australian drivers particularly are not respectful of cyclists. Mm-hmm. And I have had many friends have quite nasty accidents. So I was obsessed. I became obsessed with this notion of the rail trails, which, as you would know, are all over the US, but mainly in the West.
Right.
Because they're the old gold mining
rail
trails. So my goal was to stitch together 5 rail trails and make that kind of the heart of the trip. And we'll talk about it later, but there was parts in between those rail trails where there was, say, a whole state that I just didn't want to ride on the road in. And so ended up, hiring a car. So that's kind of where this tour is probably a little bit different to some of other extreme adventurers, is where I prioritized safety was one, rail trails was 2, and 3 was just doing stuff I wanted to do. So, you know, there was a point where I needed to get back to the Grand Canyon, and I rented a car and I drove for 10 hours and that was just for the day and that was fine. So there was a couple of parts in the tour where I was really just anchored on doing really cool stuff. And if that meant a fast forward, as I called it, then why would you ride? I mean, how long would it take you to ride a 10-hour drive? Like days, right? which you would sort of lose.
Right.
So, yeah.
Very interesting. And So the safety thing, was that something kind of like just that it was like deep down in you, or was it something that your wife's like, okay, I'll let you do this trip, but it needs to be careful and it needs to be well thought out? And
yeah, a bit of both. I mean, I had ridden on the roads in America. We lived in New York, we lived in Canada, so I knew what it could be like. Mm-hmm. And I'm 51. I just, you know, 12-year-old daughter, lovely wife. I didn't want to do it to them. I mean,
your wife's like, listen, I love being a mom, but I don't want to be it alone.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. That's bang on. And I just sort of thought, if I'm on a freeway or on a busy road in the US and I get hit by a car, I mean, that's just going to be disastrous I'm going to have no bike. I may or may not be in hospital. The American medical system is, you know, as you know, can be incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to spend as much as I can on a trail. And actually probably I rode near on 3,000 Ks. I would say I rode 100 on the road.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah. That's like nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I probably rode 10 Ks on a not the major I-90 type thing, but that's the one step down freeway. Mm-hmm. I rode about 10 Ks on. That was like four lanes wide, trucks coming at 100 Ks an hour. That was probably only 10 Ks that I ever felt really perilous. But yeah, I didn't have a choice. So.
Yeah, sometimes you get kind of like just stuck. Like there's no, you have no option, you know. You got to get to where you need to go so you can sort out your next stage or whatever.
Exactly right.
Any other goals based around this this adventure?
Yeah, sure. So I wanted to stay safe. Wanted to do some really cool stuff. I'd always wanted to whitewater raft the Grand Canyon. Yeah, so in the middle of my trip, exactly. And honestly, I would tell you, for anyone listening, if you want, I mean, I didn't do it as a family holiday, but there were plenty of families who did.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine a better holiday for a family of, you know, you're on this raft, you're going down the Grand Canyon. The walls are a kilometer high, and it's just days of days of days. And it was hot. It was 43 Celsius. So I was drinking 10 liters of water a day. But there was a couple of families with me, and I just watched the bonding between the father and the son, or the dad and the daughter. And, you know, it was phenomenal. So that was a goal. And I think the third one was I had become quite tightly wound, I would say, at work. I had a busy job, an important job, and I probably had lost sight of who I was and what was important.
So. I was about to say, well, clearly not important enough, but
exactly. Yeah.
But no, I think anything at sea level, and there's a whole next level of stress that can build into your lifestyle, right?
Yeah. And I think I had let little things stress me, you know, unimportant things stress me. So I was kind of seeking solitude and time alone. And boy, did I have I had a lot of that. So, because I didn't go with anyone, I didn't ride one day with anyone. I didn't ride an hour with anyone. I didn't plan it with anyone. I had no outfitter helping me. I had no help at all. So it was total solitude.
Nice. Okay, so tell us a bit about the route. You started. I mean, you left British Columbia, right?
Yeah. So I started. So firstly, I had to buy a bike.
I love it. You already have me. This is amazing because. You went on a bike tour and you didn't even have the bike beforehand, right? So like you.
Well, I hadn't been. So I had one of the directors on our board had a very, very nasty accident.
Okay.
In a very benign part of Sydney, and it was actually in a coma. And that sort of put me off. So I hadn't been on a bike for 2 years, period.
Okay.
Like had not turned a pedal for 2 years.
Until those 5 weeks before the tour?
No, I didn't. No, it was, I didn't have time to go out riding. So I was I've got a Peloton bike here, you know, the indoor Peloton.
Yeah, yeah.
With this big screen. And I was too busy, you know, buying stuff and train, you know, getting ready. So I hadn't been on the bike and I didn't have a bike that was appropriate. I had a Specialized Roubaix, which I didn't think was appropriate.
Right.
And then I had just to go into the shops bike that which wasn't appropriate. So yeah, immediately I need a new bike. So I picked that up in Seattle. A particular bike I wanted was only available in Seattle. So I flew into Seattle. I caught the train up to BC, up to Vancouver, which I hadn't been to, believe it or not, living in Canada all that time.
Yeah.
We actually had a baby in Canada. So we were unable to travel for a year or so. So I hadn't actually been to
Vancouver. And it's just a little bit far from Toronto.
It is, yeah, I know, 5 hours or whatever. It's a fair way.
Yeah, yeah.
Started in Vancouver. Just stunning, riding around that, I think it's the big park down there on the water.
Oh, yeah,
Stanley Park, mm-hmm. Having kind of shakedown rides, you know, filling the panniers for the first time.
Did you do any of the mountain rides, like Cypress, Grouse, or?
I did go out to some of the beaches. Some of the sounds out there just to test that out as well. But in leaving Seattle and getting on the train and going up to Vancouver, on day two, I went to the post office and and posted home about 6 kilos of stuff that I already knew I didn't need.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least you figured it out in day two.
Well, I went again on day 10 and about day 20. I had three goes at the post office. Just shedding things. So for anyone who's doing research on this and you look at the videos and there's the middle, I would take the minimalist route.
Yeah.
So started Vancouver, and then went across to Vancouver Island, which one of the most beautiful places on earth, I think, actually, to Victoria out there, and had my first proper ride, I would say, out there, sort of riding in from the ferry, and then spent 3 days riding around Vancouver Island as well.
It's pretty, isn't it?
Oh, just beautiful. And that was sort of everything was a shock. You know, the bike was heavy, I was heavy, you know, diets changing, you know, just a lot going on for mm-hmm. that first week. And then I caught a ferry straight down into Washington, the top of Washington State.
Yep.
And that's the first sort of trail was it's called the Olympic Discovery Trail.
Okay, so I've heard of it, yeah.
100 Ks. Yeah, 100 Ks goes right out to the Pacific Ocean, a place called La Push, which is famous for the, like, that vampire series, the Twilight books.
Oh, okay, so yeah.
Seem to be a lot of tourists out there seeing that. So that was the first sort of 3 or 4 days on a trail. And again, you know, 100 Ks each way without a car is just a joy.
Yeah. So some of these trails, the way things worked was just kind of an out and back sometimes or could connect if you could make it.
Out and back. On that one I did, I think it was 100, so it's 240, I think. So I had two nights. So just 80 okay. Ks stay.
Yeah, yeah.
Sleep, 80 Ks sleep. And that was kind of my goal. 80 to 100 a day was kind of my sort of goal.
And so there. Since you were staying at the same hotel, presumably, for the two nights?
No. So
no, okay.
Yeah, it's not exactly an out and back. There's sort of a range, but
okay. I was gonna say you could just ditch a bunch of hotels.
No, it wasn't like that.
Let's jump into the bike stuff. But before that, I want to ask you. So I know that you were mentioning the stressors of being a CEO and all these things and wanting to make a change. So I guess there's a certain level of personal growth you were looking at through this challenge. Things you were looking to maybe discover or change about yourself?
100%. And really sort of, you know, when you're in these big jobs and these big cities, with lots going on in your personal life, you just don't get much time to yourself. And I kind of wanted to spend time talking with people. And, you know, I'm a friendly guy, so we'd go to a bar at night. I'd just sit up, pull up at the bar and just chat to whoever, you know, plumbers, lawyers, doctors, tradesmen, carpenters, you know, any will of life. And I really wanted to sort of get back out there and talk to as many people as possible. But really it was this time of alone thinking about my life so far, you know, what achievements am I most proud of and least proud of, relationships, family, friends, what jobs have I loved the most? What jobs have I not loved? Which types of things have I done in my life where I've really enjoyed it? And which types of things have I not enjoyed it, and how do I want to spend time going forward? So like this ongoing prosecution of my life so far. And I think it was a midlife, I won't call it a midlife crisis, but a midlife review.
Right.
That I was really hoping to get, and I absolutely got it. And it took about 3 weeks, but there was one day in Idaho where I was riding and my mind just went empty. And I was like, right, I'm completely free. I have no commitments. And I have nothing to think about. I'm at complete zen moment of flow state, and I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. And that kind of stayed throughout the whole trip and has continued since I've been home.
Okay. So just a chance to really empty yourself of all that stuff.
Yeah. Stuff. Exactly. Yeah. And stuff in many forms, but really achieve an inner level of peace, which sounds a bit woo woo, but, and I never thought I'd find it riding a bike across Idaho, but I did.
Yeah. Kumbaya, my friend. Kumbaya.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
So tell us about your bike. Tell us what you decided to go with and why you decided to get what you got.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is probably the, I would say the bike was the biggest decision I made. I was looking at some of the Kona, you know, Surleys and, you know, these kind of classic bikepacking bikes. I spent hours and hours on bikepacking.com and having a look at all the setups. And I was talking with a former boss one day, and he's like, mate, have you thought about an electric bike? Have you thought about having an e-assist bike? And I said, well, not really, because I don't think that's achievement. I don't think I will feel like I've ridden 3,000 k's.
Oh, okay, so it's more of just a personal sense of unaccomplishment or something.
Personal sense of unaccomplishment. And he goes, mate, you're 100 kilos. You have grand ambitions. I think you're going to feel better at the end of the day and be able to go out and get to a town at 1 or 2 o'clock, because mm-hmm. I started pretty early, and go and have a look around and be fresher if you do this. And I, for a week, I was like, no, I'm going with a road bike, classic road bike. And then I was sort of, I listened to all your guests and other podcasts and these extreme fitness challenges and these extreme people.
Yeah.
Even yourself, after your conference, riding so far on your own. And I just thought, I actually now want to prove to others of my age and of my fitness level and of my weight and of my background, I'm not an athlete, right? Like, some people are just good at sport and they've got great VO2 max.
And they can
do anything. That is not me. I struggle running. I'm a good swimmer, but I struggle running. I struggle on the bike. So I thought, took me a week and I rang him and I said, I think you're right. I think I'm going to do this. And even going into it, I was like, I think this is cheating. Until on day one when
you realize you don't actually have anything to prove to anybody but yourself.
Exactly right. And I was going up this hill in Vancouver, of which there are many, and it was a breeze. And I thought, hang on, I feel there's something here. So look, there were days that I didn't even turn it on.
Okay.
And there were days when I drained the battery. So anything flat to sort of 3-4% incline, I didn't even use it. But once on some of the rail trails in the Dakotas, it got to 7s, 8s, and 9s.
Yeah, in Canada too, the rail going through the Rockies, it gets up about as steep as you can go with the train,
Yeah.
Something like 7, 8, that kind of thing.
Right, which is the cap, right? It caps mm-hmm. out with the train lines. Mm-hmm. But I did, and there was actually one day in the Dakotas where it was a 17K climb, and I was determined to do it alone, without the pedal assist. So that was great. But then there was days in, the Grand Canyon when I knew I wanted to ride 150, and there's no way I could do that in 43 degree heat without the pedal assist.
So. Yeah, and you're also limited to how much battery and how long it's going to last. So you got to kind of play it smart with when you're turning it on, when you're turning it off. So what bike did you go with?
I got a Specialized Creo. If you look at it, if the naked eye looked at it, it looks like a road bike.
Okay, I'm going to Google it here.
Have a look at it, yeah. Specialized Creo 2. So the battery is in the down tube. So it's kind of, and it looks quite thick around the pedals and the cassette, but really you wouldn't probably know that it was.
Oh, yeah, okay. But just popping it open here. Yeah, I mean, you can tell, but not too much, right? And I saw road bike, but does it kind of identify as a gravel bike or is it some kind of in between?
I think Specialized have done a pretty good job. I reckon it's in between. So I had some pretty wide tires on it. And so for me, it was a gravel bike. And I was on gravel 90.
Yeah, it's got like, 90, well, the one I'm seeing here has a DT Swiss G540 wheels, which are definitely gravel line.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was running like 38 mils wide. And so for me, it was a gravel bike. And I rode a lot of gravel. All these bike paths we're talking about are gravel.
Yeah, the vast, vast majority of them. Sometimes in Canada they're paved, but not that often.
Yeah, okay.
So how much mileage could get out of a battery if you were running it? And
So I became quite good at gear. If you follow the Specialized Creo forums, how much can you get out of it?
Right.
I got up to 100 Ks out of it on some hilly days. But you've got to be really smart. So, for example, its default setting has, 30%, 60%, 100% type thing. Whereas I found a setting that was going up in tens. So I could go, I might run it as 10%. So the maths is quite simple. If you're putting out, say, 100 watts and it's at 10%, you're putting out 110 watts.
Right.
120 watts. So it's pretty... It's pretty simple math. I would normally put out 200 watts, call it, say, or 180 watts, say. Mm-hmm. So you just do multiplication to that. there was a couple of days where I was really tired and I had it firing, and I would say doing my 200 and plus 100, and I was holding, you know, 40 k's an hour for an hour, which never in my lifetime would I ever do that.
Oh yeah, because you bought in the US, it could actually go up to 45 kilometers an hour, because in Canada they can only go 32. Yeah,
same here. Yeah, so 28 miles.
Yes, right.
The theoretical cap.
Yeah.
But again, so I was carrying also a lot of weight. So the bike fully laden was 70 pounds.
Okay.
With all my gear.
That's not bad when you consider it's an e-bike and it probably weighs upwards of around 40 pounds.
Yeah. Yep.
It looks like a little bit lighter than mine. Mine's, I think, 40 something, closer to 50.
Yeah. I think it was 38 pounds.
Yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah,
so that's only 10 pounds more than my fat bike.
I know, it's a great bike. It was a great bike, and then obviously I had the two panniers at the back, and then I had a top tube bag, and then I had a handlebar bag.
Okay, and did you do any modifications or upgrades to it before you started, or it was just kind of like you had the plan? And
it's funny. I have had a lot of saddle sore issues in my life. I've done a couple of 3x150k days on charity rides.
Okay.
And I'd had some really bad issues. And I bought the saddle that came with the bike, knowing it wasn't going to work. And I was put onto a brand called SMP Saddles.
Yeah, I know the
Italian brand.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know them, but it kind of almost goes up behind your bum almost.
I think like SMP is, they're made by Sell, aren't they? Or SES?
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. And then at the front, it sort of drops off. So I actually went to Vancouver. I went to this, the Canadian Saddle Fitting Company.
Oh, yeah.
And it was literally in a guy's house, like under his house in Vancouver. And when we went out there, it was miles out of town. My mate had to drive me. And I walked into his back room, and he had honestly 100 saddles on the wall. And he had a stationary bike. And he said, and he made me sit on something that measured where my sit bones were. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go to the running shoe shop type thing?
Yeah. We just did it the other day for my wife. Yeah.
There you go. So he just started putting stuff on the saddle, like this one, this one, this one, this one. So I tried about 50 saddles, and he put the Selly SMP on. I was like, that's the one.
Oh, wow.
Okay. He said, that'll be 220 Canadian dollars, please. I was like, oh my God, I feel sick. But anyway, fine. And I would tell you, between that and a few other things I did with to prevent saddle soreness, I did not have one issue.
That's great.
At all.
It is really hard. I got to talk to this guy. It is really hard to find the right saddle. I mean, you can spend a fortune. My newest, my gravel bike I just built up has the new Physic 1-to-1 seat saddle. So it's custom molded to my butt.
Yeah.
I've only been on a couple of rides with it, so I had a bit of sores, but it was because I had sores going into that ride from my commuter. So I have to let myself be all healed and cured up. I changed the seat on my commuter so I can try to sort that problem, so I can then really judge how the other saddle is. But it's really comfy. But that's a $700 saddle.
Right. Well, yeah, because I also looked at the... I think Specialized have one that was 3D printed.
They got the Mimics and...
Mimics, yeah. That's it, yeah. Yeah, I just shot you a photo of the bike anyway. You can check out the saddle. But
okay.
It's... I'm so glad I went and did it because, if you go to one bike shop, they've got so many saddles, and I feel like you're always in position to change saddles heaps. So whereas sitting in this guy's basement, that's what I was there to do. So,
and there are some shops that will do saddle lendouts, you know, as long as you're not... damage and stuff.
Will they?
Test them out. There are. I've heard of shops that do it, but I don't know any. but some companies will. Anyways, but
yeah. So saddle was the major modification.
Yeah, and all right. And you still have the saddle? Did you keep it after?
I kept the saddle. Sadly, I could not keep the bike.
I had a feeling because of the battery and all that, right?
Yeah, I tried everything.
You couldn't ship the battery by sea?
No. So I went to UPS, FedEx, and the third one, whatever the big third one was, DHL. And I literally walked into their offices and said, here's what I want to do. And you cannot ship a battery by sea or by air.
Which is mental because how did the bikes with the batteries get to the stores in the first place, right? Like how do they get from Asia to America, you know?
It's crazy. And I actually was on, I was chatting with a fella from Specialized for a while because they reached out and said, oh, I'm interested in your trip. Can we talk about it on our socials? That was great. And on the very last day, I'd already sold the bike. He came back and he said, you know what? We want to help you. We want to get the bike home for you. I was too late.
So shit. I sold it you to can a send me a new one.
Exactly. I sold it to a fella in Washington through I sold it on Marketplace, but then there was a service that actually flew
Bike Flights,
there.
I think, yeah.
Bike Flights, that's the one. Yeah. So I did take a haircut on it, as you would imagine, but it was worth it for having, 3 months of great use.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, that's kind of, I figured that's kind of how it went. When you got an e-bike, my wife's like, why couldn't I do our trip in Europe with the e-bike? I said, how are you going to get the battery there, you know? And I actually had the idea several years ago. I thought, you know what, like somebody in Europe, but probably could work in the US too, needs to just create a system that charges batteries that, and then have bike shops on board as like rental locations. Yeah. And they make a cut, you get a cut, and people can just pick up a battery and drop it off at the next location. Yeah, the problem is I think that works easier in like Spain, Italy, Portugal, but like when you're looking at a country the size of Canada or USA, like it's pretty spread out and you're not going to have one of those in every bike shop, right? So
No, not at all, no.
Maybe on the West Coast they could arrange something like that, but yeah, people could just like those e-bikes. Power banks, you can rent, how you can rent a power bank in stores and then return it at another store. Same thing with bike batteries. It would be amazing, but it's like, yeah, I'm not going to do it. So if somebody's out there listening and you're a techie, figure that out.
I think e-bike technology will come, much like it has in cars, it will come a long way in the next 10 years. I think what we're talking about now, I suspect in 10 years will be
a non-issue.
Landscape.
Yeah. So you mentioned about comfort in the saddle. What about weight? Like, what were you carrying? What were you packing? What was your setup like?
Yep. So I had two 25-liter pannier bags, Ortlieb, which were phenomenal, by the way. If you can, if you've got the choice, I would go with the Ortliebs.
They're very good.
And so I sort of kept all my clothes and stuff in there. And then on my cross tube, I had EpiPen, so I'm highly allergic to bees. That was going to be a big problem. My lock, which I was in two minds as to whether to buy, because as you know, every lock is so heavy. There's no light lock, and if it's light, it's probably not going to do anything. Honestly, I used that like such a handful of times. I probably wouldn't have carried one next time.
Yeah, I often carry just like a little travel cable lock, like the ones you'd have for your luggage at an airport or something.
And it's sort of more visual, isn't it? It's
just more
a visual
like,
deterrent.
Yeah, like to make, and I wouldn't leave the bike out of my sight. If I popped into a store, it would be right there. And hopefully it's just so they target a other bike, But I wouldn't carry like a D-lock or something. That would just be
massive. No, you can't. You can't. I found that in most stores, like if I went into a CVS, say, to get a stock up on, Gatorade and Snickers, if you just walk in, they'll put it behind the counter, just got to ask. So I had all that there. I had my mechanical equipment, which was, and you won't believe it, I ran tubeless, and I had everything you would possibly need to fix a tubeless tire. And then I had a spare tube in case of that, which I had a pump in case of that. 3,000 Ks, no flats.
Yeah, that just means you did it right. Because if you didn't have them, you'd have had a flat every 10K.
Of course I would. So yeah, that was heavy. That was a big amount of stuff. And then in the front, sort of sitting on top of the handlebar bag, I had, exactly what you'd think, raincoat. I had 2 1-liter bags just on the stem as well, just for water. And sustenance and whatnot.
So kind of a very hybrid type system, right? Like pennies at the back, handlebar bag in the front.
Yep.
Stem bags, feed bags, whatever you want to call them.
Yep, hybrid, but on the area of comfort, I didn't want for anything.
But you didn't have a frame bag, obviously, because guessing you bought the bike and you're like, well, I'm not going to get one made, and trying to find one to squeeze into an e-bike frame could be challenging.
Exactly right. And actually, there's a really good bike shop here in Sydney, and when I was talking to him, he said a lot of people think they're going to put their laptop in there. I didn't travel the laptop, but let's say you were. The internal sizings of a frame typically is in a great shape.
Yeah, so
there's not much there, and it can't be too wide because you'll pedal on top of it.
Right. Yeah. We just had on our little trip. We just recorded last night, my wife and I, because we actually recorded a week earlier, and we had some serious breakdowns of internet at home. We had to get the company to come in and fix it and everything because something broke. And of course, it broke mid-recording. So we had no idea there was no internet till the end when I came to save it, and it's all online. And I was like, "It's not saving." So we had to re-record. And Tailfin gave us some of their 16-liter bags, and they have a laptop. I don't really call it a sleeve; I call it more like a little laptop hammock. So it kind of sleeves in, but it's got like elastics at the bottom and stuff, and it just keeps it from hitting the bottom, so that it's just kind of has a bit of bounce to it.
Yeah.
Worked really well. My wife had her work laptop with her when we went on our trip, and so we were just kind of, we had to figure out a solution, and I knew Tailfin had something, so they were good to hook us up. And
I tell you one quick story. I put an AirTag in both the pannier bags, and on the Mickelson Trail, which by the way is the king of rail trails, it's got every 5 kilometers, it's got a tool set, it's got water.
Oh, sweet.
It's this like, it's like a dolomite packed brown stone. It's the Lamborghini of rail trails. It's in the Dakotas, and it rides past, you know, Mount Rushmore, for example.
Okay.
You know, brilliant town to town. It's set out to do 80Ks. There's towns. It's just everything about it. The Mickelson Trail is just brilliant. I was on that, and my watch vibrated, my Garmin.
Yeah.
And it was like, AirTag lost, and I turned around and one of my panniers had fallen off. So because the trail was so soft, it had fallen off and just couldn't even hear it. And I was on the trail. I'd only seen one fella, but I also knew it was the pannier that had my passport.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I kicked that gear, that pedal assist into high fire up range. And I basically rode Tadej Pogačar style up a hill, trying to get to my bag before someone else or something else did.
Yeah.
And it was 10Ks. I'd gone past it, so I had to go back 10Ks.
You're like, why couldn't you vibrate on me earlier, huh?
Yeah. Well, I don't know why it took so long to. Anyway, it did. So I got there, and a fella had found it. And the one fella I had passed, actually, and he's like, oh, I didn't know what to do. And I said, yeah, I wouldn't know what to do either. So he literally just left it as it was, sitting in the middle of the trail. He thought that was the best option. So anyway, it was a lucky escape because it did have my passport in it.
Yeah, that would have just added a wrinkle to the trip. But I guess you had to figure that out at the end of the trip.
Yeah, exactly. Good learning.
Yeah, so did you? I saw that your bike was drop bar. It's very much a road style or gravel bike. What about clip ins or flat pedals? What's your jam there?
I had an SPD clip in, which I'd never ridden. I'd only ever ridden Shimano.
Like the road ones, right?
Yeah, I'd only ever ridden Shimano road. So you're SPD, right. I guess it's more like what the mountain bikers use.
Yep.
And then on the other side of the pedal, it was flat.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, I know those.
So I had options. So there was one or two days that I think I was riding, you know, 15Ks or something just to get to another town. And there was something I wanted to do in the other town. So I just literally wore my joggers.
Okay. Yeah.
But highly recommend those pedals. They were a big win.
Yeah. I'm actually thinking about getting my wife a set of those because she always rides flats, but I'm like, no, you just, you know, let's get you a set like that and get you some clip-in shoes and then try it, you know, like, or wear, I don't know, whatever. Like, yeah, I think she should try it, but it also gives you that chance, that opportunity to just wear your normal shoes if you feel like it.
Yeah, no, exactly right. That was a big win gear-wise for sure.
So let's jump back to the route. You were you were in Washington. You did the I forget Olympic Trail, right?
Olympic Discovery Trail. Yep, that was trail one.
And then from there, where did you go, and how did you get there?
Yeah, so I went. So the Olympic Discovery Trail was sort of ended up being about 240 k. So it was kind of sort of 3-ish days. So yeah. if you think about America, so Washington. So I'm basically the middle of Washington. So I'm quite high, if you sort of think mm-hmm. about it. So then I went. I rode due east still in Washington.
Okay.
And there's actually a mountain bike race, a famous mountain bike race that goes from La Push, which is where the water is, right across the state of Washington. So I rode back through Seattle, and there's a lake in Seattle that you go around, Sammamish Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up something called the Snoqualmie Trail.
And was it like all kind of bike paths just throughout yep. Washington? And
the whole way.
Yeah. Yep. Nice.
Again, I didn't see a car. I mean, I saw a car, but I was on the trail. And actually, I had a Garmin Varia as well. I don't know if you've used those. So that's the back light that also yes. picks up yes. radar.
Yeah, I got to get one of those.
Like phenomenal.
I'd like to take a moment to thank a couple more sponsors of the Bike Pack Adventures podcast. Redshift Sports was founded in 2013 by a team of mechanical engineers who also happen to be avid cyclists. From the beginning, they focused on taking a different approach to product development, drawing on their own experiences and needs to create components that make a meaningful difference to the riding experience. The highly popular shock-stop suspension system smooths out road imperfections, reducing fatigue and strain. You can check them out at redshiftsports.com or follow the affiliate link down in the show notes to help sustain the podcast. Use the promo code BPA15 to save 15% at checkout. Tailfin Cycling, designer of technical bikepacking equipment, has been creating waves in the cycling community for several years, having stepped outside the conventional boundaries of bikepacking equipment to find unique solutions that make the adventure all the better. Whether an endurance racer, bike tour, or bikepacker, these bags offer solutions for everyone. From their unique rear rack with quick release mechanism to their ingenious locking mechanism on their panniers that provide a rattle-free biking experience, Tailfin continues to push the envelope. I'm extremely pleased to have them supporting the podcast and to represent them on all my adventures.
Yeah, I've been wanting to get one. I just ran out of money.
Yeah, they're expensive. It was for me, it was just safety.
Yeah, my wife wanted to get me one, and I was like, oh, no, I'll get one a little later. And then, so I still don't have one, but I will.
They're a bit frustrating when you're on a trail and there's a road next to you.
Oh, okay. I can see that. Yeah.
It picks up the cars, so you have to turn it off. But anyway, that's
makes fine. Sense.
So yeah, there's a trail there called, it's either called the Snoqualmie Trail or the Palouse Cascades is what it's also known for. And it's kind of another 250 k's of trail.
Okay.
Which took me 4 days, and that was probably the worst trail, I'd say, if I was to rank.
Oh, really? Okay.
It had big boulders, like say 8 by 8 centimeters, like
yeah.
really proper.
We call them baby head rocks.
Yeah, yeah. What wasn't great, to be honest.
Yeah.
But as part of that was the Snoqualmie Tunnel, so that's about 4.5 k's through the mountain, pitch black. So you need your lights working. But that's effectively how you cross the little part of the Rockies that is that in that place.
Oh, very cool.
With this massive tunnel, which is just a complete lifesaver.
How long did you say it's 4.5 miles?
4.5 k's.
4.5 k's, okay.
Yeah. And that was that day where I rode through that was the worst day of the tour. So I stayed at my only one and only warm showers host, which was a lovely retired couple in a town called Clay Ellum in Washington. And lovely people, had a really nice connection with them. Next morning I took off and I listened to Google Maps, probably shouldn't have, and I ended up in a rainforest. And as I got deeper and deeper into the rainforest, I realized that it wasn't where I was meant to be, and I had no cell connection. And so I had to carry my bike, my 70-pound bike, over logs that had fallen that were 5, 6, 7 feet wide. up hills, down dales. So imagine going for a hike in a rainforest with a 70-pound bike.
Awful.
So it's 3.5 hours, and I was as close to, not tears, but I was just so frustrated. Finally, after
were there thoughts of like, I just want to go home, forget this, and
yep, I'm done. Yep. It's too hard. If this is how it's going to be, it's not for me. I finally saw a trail runner who was like, "Oh, dude, this, you'll look back on this as your favorite day of the tour." At the time, I was like, "Don't give me that. I want you to help me get my bike out of here." and he just ran off, right? And anyway, he said, "Sure enough, he said, look, 300 more yards. I promise you, 300 more yards, you'll pick up the trail." Picked up the trail, and I started my 120K bike ride.
Okay. Hey, can you grab your monitor and pull it down just a bit? It's like a...
Sure.
Yeah, just kind of like... Yeah, when you lean back, I just see your head. You're just like...
Oh, cool. my bald head.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
So yeah, that was a brutal day. Brutal.
So looking back, was it one of your favorite days of the tour?
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
It's funny how that works.
And there was a canoeing incident, which we may or may not talk about, but that was also the best day. So, no, mate, honestly, it was... The testing times are often the best.
Yeah, yeah. And any other, like you mentioned, it was the next question was going to be, what were some of the toughest moments? But I mean, that sounds pretty epic.
That one, the other one was, so the other King Trail, I reckon, well, you know, fantastic trail is called the Katy Trail.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, so it goes between... Kansas City and then St. Louis, so it's 240 miles.
Okay,
so it's 400 k's uninterrupted, fully paved, car free, towns every 20 kilometers. Like, it's just incredible. And I was on that, and I got a warning on my Garmin, which I'd never had before, saying hurricane, tornado warning.
Oh shit!
On my Garmin, and I was like, I didn't know my Garmin could get warnings. And then my phone went off. Someone gets abducted, a 404 or whatever. And then it was like, seek shelter immediately. Hurricane coming your location in 35 minutes or something. And I was looking at my map, and I had about 45 minutes to get to the hotel. And I was like, I don't know what to do in terms of a tornado. Do you go and do you chain yourself to a tree? Do you, I don't know. We don't have tornadoes.
Bend over, kiss your ass goodbye.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think I didn't know what I was going to do. So I was like, I'm riding. So I kicked it into maximum help, and I put in, you know, Tour de France level watts for 45 minutes. And I pulled into town, and the tornado hit. But that day was, yeah, when you're in the middle of a field on a bike, I don't know. I don't think it's going to end well, is it?
I mean, not if it comes that close to you, but if, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know.
So you got into town, you got into shelter. They must have had people already in like tornado shelters or whatever, bunkers.
Yeah, and then they rushed us straight down to the tornado bunker in the hotel. But that was pretty hairy. And I was taking footage of all this as well. So I sort of, every day on the tour, I was doing a 1 minute update for family and friends.
Okay.
And that was there's some pretty good footage from that day.
Yeah, I think I caught some of those on the WhatsApp channel.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And any mechanical issues or logistical nightmares that you had to deal with?
Honestly, I was very lucky. I had no, like I said, no flats. I didn't drop a chain. I had a chain repair tool. Didn't need that. I was planning out, like I talked about earlier, I chose to stay in hotels. And this is, I think, again, for people that listen to yours and other podcasts who just think, you know, it can be such an extreme sport, bikepacking and bike adventures. It doesn't have to be.
No.
It doesn't have to be. And I stayed in, I had two rules on hotels. I had to pick I picked the cheapest hotel available, and I would never stay in a chain, you know, like a Hilton or even the smaller chains, the Red Robin Inn, any of that.
Unless you you were in a town and there was zero choice. Like, that's the only thing there is, I guess.
Honestly, I think every town I stayed in had an independent family run hotel.
Okay, good.
40 to 60 US a night. So these were not,
it's not bad.
They're not fancy hotels.
That's not a, that's not like we were paying in Belgium and Netherlands. Like
those, oh no,
we had a, we had a few hotels that were like $200-$300 a night, and we were like arriving at 8-9 p.m.
Yeah, so you're not and even leaving really the next morning them.
At 10. You know, like ah, what a waste of money. But
yeah, but there's a lot of really great family-run hotels in these small towns. And, of course, they give you the best advice, right? They're, mm-hmm. they're not incentivized. You know, I'll go see my cousin Jackie, runs a diner. And so, yeah, that was sort of the only rule that I had. So I would book hotels two nights in advance. There were nights when I got in and the hotel wasn't ready. There was nights when I got in at 9 p.m., like you say. But in general, no logistical snafus, yeah. No.
And did you book through an app or did you try to call the hotels directly and book?
No, that was probably one step too far because I was on an Australian phone, right? So I didn't really have that great mm-hmm. phone access. So I just used hotels.com. It's like an Expedia product.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get 10% off every booking with that. So that you know, that added up to, you know,
yeah, yeah.
9 or 10 free.
I months. Know, sometimes like, I've done in the past is like, I mean, especially if you're in Canada, like I'm in Canada and I'll just call the hotel and I'll be like, listen, you know, I want to help you. I want to book with you guys, but on booking.com, it's this much and your website is more like, but I know you guys pay a chunk to booking.com. So if you just give it to me for that price, well, then you get all that money, you know, and most hotels are absolutely. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because I think they pay 20 or 25%. In booking fees, so
yeah, okay.
You know, if it's $100 instead of $120 off their own website, you know, well,
yeah.
If they would have got $100, they would have only got like 80 of that, you know. So
yeah, no, fair enough.
I've had a couple sense. Hotels though in a few countries. They're like, nope, can't do that. I'm like, are you sure you don't want to do that? I'm like, this does make sense, you know. If I book it through Booking, but they're just an employee, they don't care. They're just like, oh, no. But if like you said, if you call a mom and pop hotel, like they're more than happy to to keep their commission away from the big companies, you know. Yeah.
The only probably other logistical snafu I had was not a logistical; it was a nature based one. As I rode through Yellowstone,
right,
and I rode through the Grand Tetons. Which, by the way, if you haven't been to the Grand Tetons, are just an absolute pleasure of a place. Fully paved bike path, 100 km. Anyway, I rode down a road.
Were you the person feeding the buffaloes or trying to ride them or whatever it was? No.
No, I didn't feed them, but I did run into a bear.
Okay.
And I didn't have bear spray because everyone had said, don't bother. If you need bear spray, you've got bigger problems.
I don't know if I agree with that assessment. I'm like...
Well, I think the notion was you're not riding through the classic countryside like perhaps...
The mountains, yeah.
Yeah, I was on tourist roads, let's call it.
True.
Anyway, there was a bunch of people looking at me like, are you kidding me? We're all in safety of our SUVs and you're on your bike. But what a phenomenal place to be and see, though, to ride your bike through Yellowstone at 5, 6 a.m., yeah. Which is what I did. I got up early. It was super cold, but it was just brilliant.
Oh, that sounds amazing. And so you were mentioning there was a logistical issue. Oh, I guess the bear, is that the logistical issue?
The bear was an issue, yeah. The bear was the main issue. No, I had a couple of miscalculations where I sort of thought it would take me, you know, 7 hours to ride something and it took me 10 or vice versa. But honestly, a lot of planning. I'm a planner and I've got a spreadsheet. I've got it open now just to remind me of a few things and in the end, it was fine. And people sort of say, oh, how, you know, it's amazing you did this on your own. With the internet nowadays, honestly, we can all plan a, you know, you would have just done it in Europe in your family holiday. It's so easy.
Yeah, yeah. And what was your, you know, how did your wife and daughter, do you have any other kids or just the daughter?
No, so Jen, my wife, and Lucy, my daughter.
Yeah.
Look, they were supportive, very supportive. My wife and I had talked about it for many years, as I said.
Yeah.
So I was on primarily West Coast time, so I would call them at my night, their morning. So the next morning, like we're talking for you at Saturday night, for me at Sunday lunchtime, which is still, I still never get my head around. so we would talk once a day each. I'd speak to my daughter and my wife separately. So they both felt like we were connecting. And then obviously the, like you said, the WhatsApp group, I would send those 1 minute videos, and that was nice to, I really didn't feel like I was out of, I lost any connection with anyone. And we started to create a community on.
And maybe in some ways you actually like grew some connections, right? Like where you had friends, like I'm going to guess here that you have friends that you don't talk to nearly as often as you'd like to. And, you know, like everybody's so busy. And then all of a sudden now they're getting daily updates and you're probably getting more messages. And then maybe it just kind of, maybe rekindled some of those relationships.
You know what? You're the first person to say that, but that is so insightful. That's bang on, because exactly right. And I went from talking to people once a year to once a day, you know, because I had something interesting to say. But you're bang on, actually. And I have reinvigorated quite a few relationships.
Yeah, that's great.
Through this. That's you're the first person to make me think of that. Thank you.
And now, now that it's over, your friend's like, man, this guy's boring again.
Well, yes, and it's not over. Yeah. I'm cooking.
No, we're going to talk about that. Yeah,
but yes, exactly that. And look, there's been good. You know, I've obviously been out for quite a few years with quite a few people since I got back, and you know, there's a good amount to talk about.
That's awesome. Yeah, I guess like we kind of touched on it, but like you know, when you're talking about going through that rainforest and things are going really sideways and trying to stay mentally resilient, you know, telling yourself that you get that defeatist mindset. Were there any other situations that came up where you were just like, man, I'm wrecked, like mentally I'm done. I feel just exhausted, or did things kind of just get going as you got into the habits? They just kind of, you know, you started realizing like you're going to have ebbs and flows and just get to the next town, have another beer or whatever.
I would say I had a pretty positive, I got into a really good groove. I was very routine oriented. I got up at the same time. I had the same thing for breakfast. I, you know, would typically start writing at the same time. And I would say probably the opposite. I would say it went from ebbs and flows to just consistent fun. And I just, every day I looked more and more forward to the next day.
Okay.
And when you ride into a town, you don't have to worry about finding safe, secure food and accommodation for your wife and kids. It doesn't really matter where you stay. You have no idea what restaurant you're going to eat at. It is incredibly freeing. And so the longer the trip got, the more I enjoyed my own company. And I would say the more I enjoyed the bike riding. And of course, I got fitter, right? Because I hadn't done any training at all. So I started from minimal fitness. So I was getting fitter. So I was getting easier. And I was using the battery less. So not really. The only... I had a bit of a life altering moment when I caught up with a former colleague in Arkansas, and we were in the real middle of Arkansas, like proper southern, you know, hospitality, and we went canoeing for a day on a river. I thought canoeing, turned out to be whitewater rafting, and in a second in a canoe. And he said to me, oh, have you paddled before? And I said, oh, yeah, like on Sydney Harbour, we had kayaks. He said, right, you go in the back. And I thought, oh, that's probably just a strength thing or a weight thing. I don't know. Turns out you got to steer when you're in the back.
You do?
So, I didn't know that. Now I know it. And in the second rapid, we flipped the canoe and it landed on my head. And I was under it for probably 20 seconds and then finally got out from under it. And it weighed hundreds of kilos by now because of the water. I was face down going across rocks. And there was probably, it was probably only 10 seconds, felt like 10 hours, where I was like, I think we're done here.
I'm going to die here of all places.
I'm going to die in Dover, Arkansas, in a river.
You look at the shore and somebody's playing a banjo, watching you go by. Well,
seriously, with three teeth. Yeah, exactly. And that was a horrifically scary day. And it was about halfway through the tour. And actually, use it for the negative, I used it for the positive of like life really is short. I literally could have died today. This was an incredibly hairy situation and I'm going to learn from it and be better and plan better and be safer even again. And so I used it for a positive, but that was probably one point in the tour where I thought this is not going to end well.
And did you tell your wife or did you kind of keep that for a while to,
No, we made a video in the way home in the car because of the blame game started. And I lost my phone on the bottom of that river. And okay. I have a photo actually of my phone. You know, my phone, it's actually sitting at the bottom of the river in Dover. So that put a massive skewer in my plans because I couldn't navigate any longer and I couldn't communicate with anyone.
Yeah,
so I had
yeah.
to go to Walmart and buy a phone. But it was pretty funny in hindsight. But again, it wasn't for a short period.
And what did you do to navigate at that point? Like, I guess you were in a town and you just went to the town, like immediately yeah. bought a phone, right? You didn't and have to ride and
figure things out. Down in Arkansas, which is the home of Walmart, there's a Walmart on every corner type thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Nice. Anything that I know you mentioned the Grand Canyon and whitewater rafting mm-hmm. on it earlier, and maybe that's something you want to talk about, but were there any other moments as well that took your breath away that are just going to stick with you for a long time?
I'll start with the Grand Canyon. I mean, a lot of people look down on it, but that's the classic, right, as you look into it. Being in it, life-changing, but the real life-changer actually was on the first day, I didn't know anyone, right? So this was a group tour now. This is the first and only organized group thing I did. Fellow sort of sitting there, he looked to be in his mid-50s. Daughter looked to be early 20s. Started chatting to them. He was from Houston, and he ran a pest control business, family business. Daughter was an incredibly bright space engineer at a young age.
Okay.
And we became fast friends, and we were texting an hour ago before we started talking to you, and we've stayed friends. So we talk regularly. We're super supportive of each other and his business and my career, and we've become lifelong friends, and we'll at some point do an adventure together. So, you know, out of that came just this really beautiful connection. Mm-hmm. His name's Eric Mellis, and shout out to him. He'll listen to this for sure. He loves listening to all this stuff. But yeah, so you know that was phenomenal. I would say the other two really incredible moments after as part of the ride was one was Yosemite. I don't know if you've been, but
I haven't.
Yosemite's a valley, and so it's you kind of ride in, you ride out, and you watch the people climbing, and you see all the incredible nature. So riding in Yosemite early morning, again, there were bears and a range of animals, but seeing people climbing up those walls, you know, like Alex
climbing up
those sheer walls, that was brilliant. And then probably the most beautiful thing I saw was Joshua Tree. So Joshua Tree is where you see all those sort of cactus, really, mm-hmm. effectively, but it's a national park. And again, I rode through there at sunset. It was hot. I think it was 41 when I was riding. It had come down a bit. And this is interesting. I copped a bit of flack online from people sort of saying, oh, you know, you should have been way east by now and you should have been in New York by now. And I was like, well, no, that wasn't my plan. I was always going to go out and come back, you know. And I wanted to go to Joshua Tree. So if it's 41, well, you go to Joshua Tree. It's 41. You just drink a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And riding through Joshua Tree through the desert at sunset, that was breathtaking.
Yeah, that sounds pretty amazing. So you were mentioning getting flack from people. Were there some like naysayers online just because, you post stuff?
Yeah.
Everybody always has a comment when they're behind a keyboard. It's much easier.
Exactly. And look, I was on all the Facebook groups and all the WhatsApp channels sharing because a lot of people were like, oh, can we follow you on Instagram, follow the Deliberate Detour? It was just particularly one fellow who was just a really hardcore backpacker, and he couldn't understand why I wasn't riding from east to west or west to east, like going to the coast.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, because I'm, and then I said, oh, I hired a car because I wanted to cut out 10 hours of nothing in Texas. And he was like, oh, yeah. So just a bit of flack, but that's fine. Like you said, I had nothing to prove to anyone but myself, and it was my holiday, not his, and I regret nothing.
So you got as far as Texas?
I got as far as St. Louis, which if you look on a map is kind of two-thirds of the way across.
Right.
Under pedal power, let's call it. Mm-hmm. And then my mate picked me up at St. Louis and went down to Arkansas, which is where we had our Arkansas
incident. Canoe adventure, yeah.
I then drove all the way to Las Vegas. So that was sort of, okay. 16 hours. And then I was back on the bike again. So if I'd had a year or 6 months, sure. If I'd had, didn't have family, sure. But I gave myself 78 days and I was like, right, I'm going to make the absolute maximum out of this because I need to go home and find a job and I need to go home to my family. So I can either ride across Texas or I can go to Grand Canyon.
Yeah, yeah. And you made it, you made it all the way to St. Louis. That's pretty far east.
Yeah, if you look on a map, it is. Yeah.
I was thinking that it was pretty far east, and I'm thinking like, okay, well, like, how on earth? Why would you drive to Las Vegas after that? But yeah, whatever. Like, why not?
Yeah. I would love, and I probably will. I would guess in the next 5 years, I will ride coast to coast.
Okay.
I'll do the Astoria to, you know, whether it's that organized ride or.
Or something that's off-road and not on trails, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd love to do the Divide race. I'd love to actually ride across Canada, having done a little bit of it. It's just so beautiful.
The Great
country.
Northern Bikepacking Route, man. It's calling you.
How far is that?
It's 14,000 kilometers.
14,000?
Yeah. The Great Northern Bikepacking Route was created by Matt Cady a couple of years ago. He's created quite a bit of routes in Ontario. And then I had actually been thinking, like, man, somebody needs to put a better route across Canada because there's a transcontinental trail or trans-Canadian trail. But it's really not a biking route per se. It's a mix of everything, you know? Like, when you hit Lake Superior, it's a water trail, you know? Like, it's...
Right.
And then some sections are really hiking trails and some sections are, you're on a main road, you know? So he reached out to a bunch of route developers like myself and others and took chunks of our routes, put them all on a map and then started figuring out how he could connect them. And he created a route that is just shy of 14,000 kilometers across. He called it the Great Northern because it's not just through Canada. At Lake Superior, it cuts south of Lake Superior through the U.S. Just because there are trails there and gravel. And if you're on the Canadian side, it's literally one highway.
Yeah,
So he made it go south. And so it's not just purely Canada, but it's pretty phenomenal route.
If you meet me in the middle, we can cycle to your hometown from there.
How about that? There we go. Let's aim for the year where I'm not working in a couple of years from now.
Yes, I heard about that. That's exciting.
Yeah. We'll see. Trying to figure that out. That one I really have to sit back and kind of like look at a 14-month calendar and say, okay, what do I want to do? Where do I want to go? And like which of it will be with my wife and kid and dog and which would be like just me? So I think I want to do something in South America.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, I mean, not the whole South America, but maybe a chunk of it. I don't know yet. Just trying to figure that out.
You don't want to ride around Australia?
Not really. No, there's a lot of poisonous shit there.
Lachlan Morton, I don't know if you
I saw his record. That is mental.
Like 450K day. I mean, it's just... Anyway, I can't get my head around it.
Well, it's very similar to the guy that I forgot his name all of a sudden, but that has the record for around the world, right? He was insane kilometers per day.
Even Leah Wilcox. I don't know if you listened to her podcast.
Yeah, hers was I listened to a bunch of them, not all of them, but
yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. Now she wants to go and do it again faster.
I think she wants to break the it's a Scottish fella anyway.
What's his name? Oh my god. I'm just thinking Alistair Humphreys? No. Is it?
No. I think we're in around there. We're dancing around the right language, but I think she wants to break his record actually.
Oh so. Yeah, she's looking to do that. That's amazing. That'd be phenomenal. I hope she does. That'd be cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any unexpected encounters? I know you mentioned the bear, any other wildlife things that you're just like, oh man, look at that, you know? Or
yeah, I mean, the bison.
Yeah, bison.
Sort of, you know, coming so close to you, that was very cool. Saw quite a few snakes on the Katy Trail, which I didn't expect. And I don't love snakes, albeit we have a lot in Australia. Saw a couple of moose, very impressed with that. They were way bigger than I thought they would
be.
Yeah,
they're massive.
And I did see a bear, I did see a black bear on the Snoqualmie Trail, and that was early in the trip, and I wasn't prepared for it. I had done the reading around what to do and whatnot.
Black bear is like the most timid of all of them, so it's a good it's a good one to see.
It's a good try, a good tester, but it did shock me. Like, I didn't expect it, and it did startle me. And we did have a bit of a standoff as to who was going to pass who, but you know,
this is the time of the year now where I live, where like when I'm in my garage right now doing this, and when I go to leave, I'll like open the door, make some noise, slam the gate before I walk to the house, because bears like to come around our garbage bins and they're around. They're scavenging for winter, right? They're trying to fatten up.
Get ready for the winter.
But they're black bears, so like if they hear me, they just wander away.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
How about fellow travelers? Like any cyclists you meet that were just phenomenal people or really interesting people? Like,
yeah, I was a bit disappointed is not the right word, but I had heard, listening to all, you know, yours and many other podcasts around, you know, the community. And I don't know whether it was because I was in May, June, that it wasn't quite peak season yet, but I didn't find so many. I did ride in the Grand Tetons. I was riding and this fella kind of came past me fully loaded. And I said, "Oh, where are you off to?" And he said, "I'm off to do the divide, the Great Divide."
Okay.
And he was starting in the Grand Teton. So that is a long way from Banff, right? Or wherever it starts.
Yeah.
So he was, his name was Chris Smith. He's a retired army fella. And he had finished chemotherapy the day before the ride.
Okay.
He'd had cancer for 17 years on and off. And he'd had, he was finishing chemotherapy. And he, you know, when you meet someone that's just really tough and hard and you kind of go, "I really need to harden up."
Yeah.
That was sort of my moment. he goes, "Oh, Seb, I'm so fat. Like, I'm so not ready for this race." And I was like, "Dude, you've been doing chemotherapy for 17. Well, of course you're out of shape." He goes, "Yeah, but that's on me. I've got to be more accountable. I mean, I've been having the extra chocolate at night." And, you know, anyway, so he was riding into fitness to go and finish that.
Amazing.
The start of that ride. But that was great. That was nice. We rode together for probably an hour. Swap war stories, although he had actual war stories.
Yeah.
He'd been in Afghanistan. Mine weren't quite as good. And then just more meeting the non-cyclist, the common man. You know, one night I met the head stadium plumber for the Seattle Mariners baseball team. You know, his job was to make sure the toilets flushed in the stadium.
Fair enough. And that was just like in a pub or something, or just walking around?
Yeah. Oh, that was actually at a game. I was just sitting in the back of the game. But, you know, I met an ophthalmologist from Tucson. I met tradespeople, property developer, like just any walk of life you can imagine. And everyone has a story. Everyone has a demon. Everyone has family that they love or not. You know, everyone has physical issues, you know, like everyone has a story. And I think just the notion of sitting down at the bar every night and then, it would be very easy for me to have just eaten my meal, had my beer and gone. But every single person who sat down next to me, regardless of what they looked or sounded like, I was like, "G'day mate, Seb from Australia, how you going?" And of course, you know, 2 hours later, you're still chatting.
Especially when you have like a real foreign accent, you know, like an Australian accent, like you do stand out. And like as a Canadian, they'll just be like, they might not even notice you're not from around there.
Yeah, exactly. And they you know, Australia or New Zealand, Australia. And then we'd always end up chatting. And most of them wanted to end up following the journey on Instagram as well. So that was good that they got to sort of hear what happened after they met me.
I was going to ask you what you love most about traveling solo, but I guess that probably encompasses it there, because when you're with friends, you might not have those encounters because you're going to be sitting there together and people won't want to interject and get involved. But when you're 100%. Alone, all of a sudden people are like, "Oh, I want to know more."
Well, I had the best of both worlds, right? So I got to be on my own during the day and have that peace on the bike. And I actually took AirPods and I didn't really use them. I didn't really listen to podcasts or music. I was I was present the whole, you know, 6-7 hours a day on the bike. Mm. I was into it, which I thought was quite interesting. I thought I probably would have used them. And then at night, then I got to interact with, you know, the locals and whatnot.
Did you ever get tired of being solitary or not really?
No. And you know what? It's spoiled me a little bit, I think. So last weekend I was away with some mates up on the Gold Coast, and there was a period where I just wanted an hour on my own, and I'd never wanted that before. And I think that was because I was so used to having it from the tour. So yeah, I think the power of solitude is quite new to me, and something I crave now.
Yeah, yeah. And what kind of advice would you give to somebody that's considering some kind of a first solo bikepacking trip, or you know, somebody who's you know, doesn't feel like they're in the best shape, and
I did both of those. I did both of those. I wasn't in great shape. I was first time. I would do what I do. I would stay in hotels, and I would potentially look at an e-bike. And so make it as easy as you can. Remove the barriers of, oh, I don't want to sleep under a tent. Well, don't sleep in tents. You know, oh, the bike's going to be heavy, so I have to really get an e-bike. Like, I think just play to your strengths and where you know you're going to be weak is right. One. And two is just do it. Like, even if you just go out for a three-day, you know, a three-night weekend trip or something, like, just do it. And I've never met anyone who does bikepacking who's regretted a single trip, neither. Even the bad ones.
Yeah.
And so whilst not everyone is going to have 68 days or whatever that I had, I would just get into it, just crack into it and do it. It's not going to be bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And, that's the nut and bolts of it, you know, like that's it. Like just, you're going to have a good time. Things will work out. You'll figure it out. And you don't have to camp. Camping adds a whole new dynamic that can be quite tough or not. But I mean, especially when it comes to wild camping, a lot of people are really worried about it. And I don't even love it. Like, you know, like when I wild camp, when I'm bikepacking, I'm always like, oh, if only I could find a piece of grass or a park somewhere comfortable, you know, like instead of having to tromp down in a field and hope not to lay on an ant hill or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so what's going on now? I know you're just a couple weeks out from your next adventure. I think 2 or 3 weeks, something like that.
Yeah, 2-3 weeks. Yeah,
3 weeks. What's the plan? And tell us about it.
So this is the deliberate detour 2. I'm flying to Kathmandu, which is near India, as you may know, and I'll be hiking 11 nights and days and nights up to Everest base camp.
What prompted this?
Again, I had always been into mountaineering and watching all the videos and movies and documentaries about Everest, and I knew that there was a way you could do it, but I hadn't ever really. So now I'm actually working at the moment 3.5 days a week. I'm consulting to this really fun company, but whilst I'm not kind of full time employed, I thought I would do it, and effectively it's 11 nights. You go up and up and up through Gokyo Pass and Chola Pass and Chola Lake. It's not big distances, sort of, I think 5 is the shortest day, 10 or 12 is the longest, but it's at altitude, right? So every step will apparently feel like, you know, you are doing massive Ks. So it's a hike. It's staying in what they call tea houses, which is, I think our hotel might be a stretch. It's effectively just a few, you know, wooden boards erected to keep you out of the bitter cold. At the very top, it will be cold. It'd be minus 10, minus 20.
You're like, whatever, as long as it doesn't, I don't have to call it camping.
Correct. I right now I was out this morning, did 1,400 steps up in a local area near our house. And
that's beautiful. You sent me a little video. I was like, that's really looks nice. And
yeah, Sydney's got amazing, we call it bush or forest over here. And where I live is actually right in that. But I'm very, unlike the bike tour where I had, you know, weeks and weeks to ride into it, I have to be fit on day one from this thing because it starts going up from the airport. So I'm really training very hard.
Now, do you have to carry a lot of stuff, or do you have a, what do you call them, Gurkhas? Or not Gurkhas.
Sherpa. Yeah, so Sherpas, actually, I've learned the term for their race. So you ideally don't call them Sherpas. I always thought you would, but apparently that's like saying, oh, that's an Asian person, or that's a Mexican, so you don't call them.
Oh, it's not an ethnicity, or it's a, is it an ethnicity?
It is an ethnicity, yeah. So versus a... so there's porter, which are the person who carries, and then there's a guide, porter and guide.
Okay.
So porter will carry 15 kilos, and the strong recommendation is that you use one for two reasons. One is it's hard enough anyway.
And you support the local economy, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, you support the local economy. So I'll have both, and then you carry 7 kilos of, you know, wet weather gear, snacks, water, whatnot. So I've been training with that on my back at the moment.
Yeah. What's the snack of choice?
I like the Clif white macadamia nuts.
Oh yeah, those are good. The Clif ones, yeah.
Yeah, that's my. And then just the we call them lollies here. Just candy.
You call it like a lolly, like with a stick, like a sucker, or no?
Like a snake.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Like the little gummy snakes or whatever. And
yeah, we have much different shapes and sizes and whatnot over here than they have in the US and Canada.
Yeah, but,
almost like a red Twizzler, that type of thing.
That's what it would be. My bag would be full of Twizzlers and gummy bears and like jujubes. Americans call them jujubes because I don't know why, but yeah.
Yeah, and then Mars bars.
Mars bars, yeah. I'd prefer those to Snickers any day.
I agree.
Yeah. Their melting point is a little bit lower than a Snickers. So if you're out in really hot weather, definitely the Snickers is the way to go. Those things are like almost melt-proof. Yeah. So God knows what they're made of. But
yeah, but they're great for energy, right? A quick hit.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. And how'd your wife feel about this next trip? She was like, I've unleashed a demon here? Or like,
I said, do you want to come? She was like, I just don't think it's for me. So, and it's obviously much shorter than the detour one. But then she's off in July. She's going to go off and do a week-long art course in Greece. So, you know, we support each other in our dreams.
When you get to those 40s, 50s and up, and you know, you're more comfortable to do stuff on your own as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, exactly right.
Yeah. I guess because also like as you get into the second half of your life, you're like, you know what? We only have so much time. You don't like doing this. Don't do it. I'm going to do it. Mm. And we'll figure out, you know, the rest of our lives together. We just do our little adventures and make the most of those moments, right? Awesome, man. Anything I didn't talk about or bring up that you wanted to chat about today?
No, I mean, I think I would just come back to it doesn't have to be extreme wild camping, hard, heavy, tense, dehydrated food. Like, you can do it in hotels, you can do it with pedal assist bikes. And I would rather hear about, and I think also at early 50s, I've got to make more money. I can't take time out of work. You're just never going to regret taking time. And I would tell you, every single person I've spoken to about this has said, that sounds amazing. I would love to do that one day. And I guarantee you 99% of them will not do it one day.
And that's a big reason why I decided to do that X over Y was because I had so many teachers say, man, my biggest regret is never taking that year off. And they're like, now I'm within 5 years of retiring. Your pay is your pension's based on your best 5 years. So I'm never going to do it. You know, now the kids finally moved out and I could do it, but I won't. I'll just wait till I retire. And they're like, but I wish I would have done it when I was in my 40s or early 50s even. And so that's why I told my wife, I said, if this is for me, this is a non-negotiable. I have to do it. And if we go to Europe or whatever later and for me to teach or something, well, then she can take some time off and have her own, you know, fill her bucket.
Yep. Yeah, bang on. And I think, like, just doing it. I know it's easy to say, but And I think like now I've done one, I want to do more. So maybe it's just do your first and then, and then you realize that you can live without things for a little while, or you can save a bit harder, or you can take time off work, or you can do it between. Australia at the moment has a lot of people being made redundant, thousands each day.
Oh yeah.
It's a big issue. So, you know, I've got quite a few former colleagues, peers and friends who are sort of looking for work, and same again, get out there and do something.
Yeah, my wife was saying the same. Well. She works in IT, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of competition to find new jobs now. Mm. And now they're being, you know, asked to go back to work 3 days a week as a management. And she's like, oh, I really don't want to, but you can't even threaten to say, I'm going to try to find a new job, because they're going to be like, good luck.
Yeah.
Because there's
none. Yeah, exactly. So whilst AI is finding its place, and you know, Trump tariffs in Australia are a bit of a unsettling as well. So whilst all that's kind of, you know, shaking out, and you've, in my case, got the time, you know, I'm up for it.
what's the political climate feeling like in the U.S., not the U.S., but in Australia regarding things in the U.S. these days, you know? A lot of Canadians have banned, like, just personally, they're trying not to buy American products. They're trying not to travel to the U.S. American whiskey's off our shelves, that kind of thing. So what's it been like on your side of the ocean?
We're a fair way away, geographically and politically. Yeah. Literally, you know, so we've got the distance thing. Probably not so much not wanting to travel there or take the products off the shelves. It's just more of a we've got very – our two political parties are so close on the spectrum, it's not a big gap. I think Australians, they've put this 10% tariff on our goods. Our big one is beef that we send to the US. We've opened our markets to beef. I think it's just more of a let's wait and see what happens. It's not quite as impactful for us, not sharing a border and whatnot.
Fair enough.
But I would tell you, if there's a world leader at the moment that I admire and I think is doing an incredible job, it's your Prime Minister. I mean, he is.
Yeah.
He is playing Trump, and he is brilliant. I love what he's doing. I think he's smart.
It's interesting though, because you know, like from a political point of view, like Carney is very centrist, so he's not Trudeau, that's for sure, right? He's he's cutting some of the anyways, we were paying like emission stuff, like we had some. I forget, some taxes and stuff. He cuts stuff. He's building pipelines. He wants to do this and that. And that's very, very much like conservative mindset things. And yet somehow the conservative leader, Poilievre, is still like, oh, he's not doing it fast enough, or he's not doing this. And he's trying to get more right, because he's got to try to show like that things aren't happening. But it's like, no, we have a prime minister who's right in the center now and appeals to a lot of people.
You know what's interesting?
But haters are going to hate, so.
Exactly. Yeah. They always will. They always will. But the interesting thing is we had our elections at a similar time, Australia and Canada. We had a right-ish leaning candidate, similar to you, who tried to kind of position himself as in the Trump mold, and sort of in that period between Trump taking office and these two elections – I think people were like, I'm not sure we want that.
Yeah.
Which is why your political odds of a Carney victory changed significantly in that short period, as did ours.
And I will say, I was one of those people, you know, like I was so tired. I never voted for Trudeau. I always voted NDP. But I was just tired of Trudeau being in power. And I knew if I voted NDP this election, it's unfortunately they lost their party status, because they didn't, enough people like me said, I can't do it. I need to vote for, you know, another party. And I was going to throw my hat in with conservatives, because we're just so sick of Trudeau. But then they switched to leadership, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, this Carney guy is like, he's got ideas. And it was really interesting. And then all of a sudden, like all of us that were in like my position, maybe that were tired of Trudeau or were NDP voters, swung back to the Liberals, and I don't say I'm technically a Liberal voter. I like to say I lent my vote to them this time, see how things go. But
do you have to vote? Do you have compulsory voting?
We don't. No, I think you guys do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing.
$8,500 if you don't vote.
$8,500?
No, sorry, $8,500 or $100.
Oh, okay, Jesus.
So you have to vote, and then secondly, it's on a Saturday, so sort of like most people don't work on a Saturday. And in every suburb, there'll be 10 or 12 polling booths in schools and churches.
Okay. And do they have mail-in voting as well? Or
they have mail-in voting.
Yeah.
But they give you a free sausage. So we have a sausage sandwich over here. So there's an incentive to vote.
They just jam it in your face as you walk out the door?
No. Sausage sandwich on a bit of white bread with a bit of onion, tomato sauce.
Ah, nice.
Chef's kiss.
Oh, yeah. I got to come check out this voting process in Australia. It's really interesting stuff, what's going on. I'm sure that might be part of the impact of why you didn't see as many cyclists either, is because you might not have had Canadians down there bikepacking or touring that might have gone otherwise. And
absolutely. Yeah. That's right. And go ahead. No, I was going to say, we've got one Canadian in our house. We've got a little Canadian souvenir who we had in Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. Right. So we're always forever attached to Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. Is she dual citizen then?
Yeah.
Yeah,
she is. She is. We've let her passport lapse because she doesn't need it.
Fair enough.
We'll get it back when she's 18. She wants to go and work in Whistler or something.
Yeah, fair enough. Nice. Hey, I had one question about you. You know, you did mention you're a spreadsheets kind of guy. Mm. What was your cost on the trip, like roughly on a per day average? And I'm going to guess you've got that factored in as well with the cost or the loss on the bike where you sold it and.
Yeah, loss on the bike. And then the biggest problem actually was, like I said, you know, hotel 60 US, food 30 US, and that's 90, call it 100, is our exchange rate. So our exchange rate is very poor. So for me, it was more like 170 a day if you add that up.
It's even worse than the Canadian dollar right now then.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Wait, so 66 cents Australian dollar buys you 60 cents US cents, 66 US cents.
Okay, I think we're 70.
So in the end, I was just trying not to look at the credit card statement. So I was just like.
But you're looking at like roughly 100 US dollars to get through a day.
Yeah, and then loss on the bike. Obviously, I had to fly here, fly there, which is not cheap, as you can imagine. The one thing I probably spent more money on than I thought I would was things like merino, things to ride in.
Yeah.
But they were a godsend because you can ride them, you can wear them for 3 or 4 or 5 days without washing them and they don't get smelly or dirty or anything.
Yeah, so, no, they don't. They stay relatively unsmelly. You might not want to cuddle your wife with them on, but.
I would wash in the hotel room every night as well. Yeah. So it was fine. But I did spend quite a bit of money on gear.
Yeah, fair enough, man. Cool. Anything else?
No, just thank you for having me, and thank you also for what you and other podcasters do. I mean, I know it's a labor of love, and there's probably not a huge financial reward for you.
Not much.
but I do love the fact that you do this, and I appreciate you and the others because it got me into the sport, and it's kept me in. Although at the moment I'm listening to podcasts about hiking in Nepal.
Why?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think the reason the trip went so smoothly was listening to you and Seek Travel Ride and other podcasts of just what is likely to go wrong bikepacking. And you listen to all your guests and you go, right, here's the 10 things. And now I'm listening to podcasts about trekking in Nepal because I want to know what mistakes I'm likely to make. So it's really helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. I appreciate it. I appreciate you reaching out. I did love the concept and the idea of talking about like e-bike touring. All right. Sorry, everyone. The last couple minutes of the episode got cut off. I actually ran out of space on the memory card. I was not expecting that and also had issues with the video recording. So, we just lost a couple minutes at the end. But I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on this ride with Sebastian. A reminder that adventure doesn't always start with a map, but with a moment of courage. From rail trails to river rapids, Seb's story shows us that personal growth can come from unexpected detours and that you don't need to be an elite athlete to chase something extraordinary. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who might need a nudge towards their own journey. Until next time, keep on pedaling, stay curious,
ride your bike. I want to end the show by thanking all my listeners once again for the emails and comments I regularly receive from you. It really helps motivate me and keep me going with this project and to continue sharing people's amazing stories. If you have any comments or questions, you can email me at chris@bikepackadventures.ca or go to bikepackadventures.ca and shoot me a message through the contact form. You can also check out the webpage for past podcast episodes, bikepacking routes throughout Canada, blog posts, videos, and touring tips. Lastly, I'd like to once again thank all the individuals and companies that are supporting the podcast. Head over to bikepackadventures.ca/partners for some amazing deals. If you're enjoying the show and would like to become a supporting member, head over to www.patreon.com/bikepackadventures to sign up. Patreons get to enjoy early access and ad-free podcast episodes. You can also support the show by sending a one-time donation through PayPal. This money all goes back into the podcast, helping me to cover the costs associated with running the show, buy new equipment when necessary, and continue to produce the high-quality content that you've become accustomed to. Much appreciated, and keep on pedaling.